All right. And we started talking about kosher, but we did not finish the kosher aspect, did we?
Okay.
And I've got several questions to ask you about that, as I always do. Maybe one day we'll get together on it. Okay, but that's where we got to.
Okay.
All righty. So you start, and then we'll listen.
Okay. So I believe, if I am correct, that last week we discussed the concept of kosher, and we said that the idea of kosher has to do with holiness, I believe we said, and holiness is not a mystical essence, but a holiness means where the person is removed insofar as humanly possible from the instinctual gratifications. And in that way, he reflects the holiness of the Creator. Of course, the Creator is non-physical, and the Creator is the source of all knowledge. And when man lives according to his intellect, according to his mind, there's a supremacy of the intellect. He is holy. That's why it says, you should be holy because I, God, am holy. That is the connection between man's holiness and God's holiness. So although they are two different things, there is a common thread insofar as man on man's level, he, so to speak, he can imitate the Creator by being guided by his by the supremacy of his intellect. Now, let me explain that point a little more, that kosher really, as I said, has nothing to do with health rules. Because if these were health rules, then God would give them to all people, not just to Bnei Israel, but He'd give them to the entire world. So they aren't health rules. They have to do with being holy because of the nation. The nation has an obligation to live a certain lifestyle, and as I mentioned, that's openly in. That's mentioned openly in Leviticus at the end of the laws of keeping kosher, for your own reference, it's Leviticus 11, the end of Leviticus 11, the end of the chapter there, and yes, it's the end. Okay, now. What I wanted to mention is like this, that, you see, it's interesting, but the idea of the concept of kashrus emerges from looking at the Bible, but also from looking at the interpretation, the way we understand the Bible. And in the 613 commandments, there are negative commandments with regard to keeping kosher, and then there are also positive. And this would seem on the surface to be puzzling because we can understand negative commandments. In other words, don't eat the camel, okay? Don't eat the swine. Don't eat the horse. These are all negative things because you're not supposed to do these things. You're supposed to refrain from them. That's a negative commandment. But it's interesting, in the 613 count, there are also positive commandments with regard to keeping kosher. Now, the question is, how could a person fulfill a positive commandment with regard to keeping kosher? Keeping kosher really is just avoidance of something. There's nothing positive about it. Now, with regard to the Sabbath, that there also you have a positive commandment, but that is no problem. Because, and you have to follow carefully for just a moment. It's a little bit conceptual. But with regard to the Sabbath, there is a positive fulfillment of abstention from work during the entire 25-hour period. Okay, so the abstention is considered a positive thing because when a person abstains from something which is natural for him to do, so then this is a positive concept. The same thing with fasting. Fasting, not eating for the 25-hour period on Yom Kippur. That also is a positive commandment. Why? Because the abstention is viewed as a positive thing. You ordinarily would eat, and now you abstain. So abstention is considered a positive kind of a thing. It would be the best example would be to, if you think about it from a logical standpoint, it would be the difference between blindness and if a cat is blind or if a bat is blind. See, a bat really truly is not blind. A bat just has a very limited eyesight. That's its nature. That's not considered blind. Blindness is a positive thing. Blindness means a cat would be blind because their sight should be there and it's missing. It's called a privative. Something has been deprived of something. So the deprivation is considered a positive thing. So blindness in a person, for instance, is considered a positive thing. He is blind. It means he's deprived of sight. Since sight belongs to him naturally, so then he's being deprived. That's a positive concept. That's the same thing. That's how there's a positive concept with keeping the Sabbath. Otherwise, there's nothing positive about the Sabbath. It's just negative. It's things you can't do. But there is a positive commandment as well, because through abstention, through depriving yourself from that which is natural to you, there is a positive entity. That's why when the Torah says you shall work for 6 days, it's not a commandment. It doesn't mean you should work. You must work. If a person is wealthy, he doesn't have to work. It means the nature of man is to work during the 6 days. That's his nature. That's what he's involved in. He's permitted to do this, and this is something which is natural to him. Therefore, when the Sabbath comes along and he abstains, that becomes a positive kind of a concept. He's abstaining now from what he normally would be doing. That's why the Torah says you should work for 6 days. It doesn't mean you should work. You must work for 6 days. It means to say there's no Sabbath unless you construe, you understand man as being a six-day worker by nature. And now, that's fine when it comes to the Sabbath. Even though it's negative, it still is. There's a positive commandment as well, which counts as one of the 613. But when you come to keeping kosher, there it becomes a little more difficult. How could you say there's a positive commandment not to eat pork, for instance? That's not. There's nothing. You can't say abstention from pork. I mean, it's not man's nature to eat pork or to eat camel or
something. Rabbi?
Yes.
Before you get back to that one, you mentioned the work on the Sabbath. We've been told by some in the past that it was the Ben Noach was obligated to work on the Sabbath. In fact, we've been told that the Ben Noach, if he failed to work any day, that he could be punished even to the point of being put to death for failure to labor. That it said, for instance, we were told if we took a vacation, the Ben Noach, if he took a vacation, he should do some kind of meaningful work on every day because he was not permitted not to work. And even on the Sabbath, see, we could acknowledge the Sabbath, as we've said before, without doing one of the 39 prohibitions, but to say that we're obligated to do some type of work, I would like for you to elaborate on that.
Okay.
And then before you get back to the kosher, see, if we're doing this as far as sanctification for the name of God,
yes. Okay.
Then it would be a positive thing. All right, you see where I'm coming from?
Yes, I understand.
Okay, all right.
All right. According to Maimonides, let me take Maimonidean view. There's Rashi has a view here also. But according to Maimonides, the violation for the Ben Noach is to not that he has to work the last Rambam, not that he has to work every day, but he's not allowed to proclaim a holiday, which means that he's creating a kind of religion on his own. That's the way Maimonides has it. Now, the Sabbath is not right. The Sabbath, if he abstains from work on the Sabbath, since he's not commanded to do this, it would be considered as if he made up his own religion, and that's what is wrong with that, because the Ben Noach is the Ben Noach has no and as far as Sabbath is concerned, that's not a commandment which is appropriate for him. Now, since that doesn't exist in the Torah for the Ben Noach, his positing, his acting on the Sabbath as if his abstaining from work on the Sabbath in a positive way, the violation is not so much because he's not working, not at all actually because he's not working, but it's because he's creating a holiday for himself. And that, as you know, is a major philosophical and halachic violation for the Ben Noach as well as for the Ben Israel, as we read in last week's reading. You're not allowed to add or to diminish. So with the idolatrous trend of the human mind begins when man starts creating
Rabbi,
laws.
A point.
That is Maimonides' interpretation.
All right, but a point. What if we take not creating a holiday,
right,
but the Ben Noach can take upon additional mitzvot,
right,
if he chooses?
Yes, but not the Sabbath.
All right, but he could. What? Why not the Sabbath? Not as a Ben Israel. But we go back to the fact that God rested on the seventh day, and you have this seventh day concept that is in the Torah pre-synaptic.
Okay. I'll try to go a little bit deeper with this.
Okay.
And that is, like they see, a Ben Noach can do a mitzvah. He can do a mitzvah, according, I mean, there's no question about that. That he, for instance, he could take a lulav. He could take an esrog. He could sit in a sukkah. He could do those mitzvahs because those are positive things. But since the Sabbath is a question of whether it is, see, Sabbath, you can't make the Sabbath. Sabbath is something which exists. Now, since it doesn't exist for the Ben Noach, because he's not part of the 613, if he were to treat it as if it exists, he would be, in essence, just making up his own holiday. That's why Maimonides says he can't rest on the Sabbath or any other day of the week as well. In other words, he can't create a day of rest. Now, insofar as recognition of Sabbath philosophically, which you mentioned, that's certainly the Ben Noach is obligated to do, to recognize, because that's the fact of creation, that God, that the harmony of the universe did not appear until the seventh day, and there were various stages of creation, the first through the sixth, and then on the seventh there was the harmony was created in the universe, and God created these stages and the ultimate harmony. That concept that Ben Noach is obligated to accept, and he certainly is permitted, and it is even virtuous for him to recognize this. He could do this on the Sabbath, and he could recognize this, and this is fine. But he shouldn't treat it as a holiday in terms of halacha. He shouldn't create any halacha which wouldn't apply to him. That's the only violation. Okay. Are there any questions on that?
All right. I would come back to the point as if it's a point of clarity. On a philosophical level, we can acknowledge the seventh day.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But we're not creating a holiday. All right. I don't know of anyone that would want to observe the Sabbath as do you as a Ben Israel.
Mm-hmm.
But since it is a biblical, and I don't want to use the word holiday, but it's a day that God blessed,
right,
in the creative aspect,
right,
I think we could enjoin that day and acknowledge it as the day that God blessed and set apart from in the harmony of the universe, as you said.
Yes, that's correct.
But that's not creating
no. A
holiday. But then to say that I must go out and do some type of physical labor, see, I think
no, that's
that,
not true. That's not true.
Okay, I think that would be putting an additional mitzvah upon me. We have six negatives and one positive. And then if you say, well, you've got to work on the Sabbath,
right,
then you're adding to Ben Israel would be adding to my mitzvahs then.
That's correct. That's correct. This is the view that we've discussed is by all means correct, and that's the view of Maimonides.
Okay, and then secondly, in the same vein, to say that if I do take a holiday, go to Gulf Shores, Alabama, or up to the mountains, and to say that I have to do some type of positive work in that, I think that's adding to the mitzvah also.
Well, that's correct. That's the view of, I mean, what your questions are very good, and the view of Maimonides is exactly the way I explained it, and there is no obligation for the Ben Noach to work every day. And that's basically the accepted view. The reason why you got into this problem is because there is a Rashi in the tractate of Sanhedrin, which has his own interpretation. He gives a different interpretation. It's not like Maimonides, but as I said, I feel that the main authority in this area really is Maimonides, and there is, however, Rashi, which does say a strange thing. It is a very strange Rashi, but Rashi interprets that very same piece of the Talmud, where it says that a non-Jew that rests on the Sabbath is in violation. So Rashi says that it means that he rested from his work a complete day. He's not allowed to cease from work for a complete day. Now, that's where you got that other information from. And that's not Maimonides' opinion. As I said, that's not the mainstream opinion. That's the opinion of Rashi. Now, in my opinion, just to explain Rashi's concept a little bit, just to give you an idea, the reason for this, for Rashi's interpretation, which sounds at first very strange that you can't take a day off, is based on the concept that it is not good for man to be idle. You see, now the reason why, because you'll ask a question, you'll say, well, how come the Ben Israel can take off days and the Ben Noach cannot take off days? That doesn't sound fair. But according to Rashi's opinion, what Rashi maintains is that the philosophy of Torah is, it is never a good thing for a person to be idle. Now, when the Ben Israel, for instance, has a holiday, his holiday, if it's done properly, and most B'nai Israel do not do it, unfortunately, properly, he's supposed to be studying the entire holiday. As a matter of fact, when you have like this whole week, like Passover or Sukkot, you have an entire week, the days in the beginning, and the days in the beginning days, the beginning holy days, and the ending holy days, you're supposed to be studying half a day. We in the yeshiva get up at about 5 o'clock in the morning, and we study until 1. And the holiday is the second half of the day, which usually you wind up eating a nice meal and then going to sleep because you're so tired from getting up early. But the during the intermediary days, you're really supposed to spend them in study as well. A holiday, frankly, if it's kept properly, according to the Torah law, doesn't resemble anything of a holiday that people think or have in mind, you know, when they want to go on holiday. The Torah's holiday is a lot of work. It's really hours of study and prayer, and it's actually, as I said, it's like from 5, we're in it usually from about 5, depending on, you know, the time of the year, 5 to 1. That's a total of 8 hours. So the Torah's idea, the Torah's concept is much different than our concept, the American concept of having fun. The Torah really believes that man is happiest when he's engaged in doing something. And idleness, just being idle and just laying around, is not considered in the eyes of Torah as being a virtue. That's why it states, that's why Rashi interprets that the Ben Noach, who has no obligation to study Torah, and who is not involved usually in the study of Torah, if he's just going to take a day off, it really is a waste, and it's an idleness is something which is really not a good thing for man. A person is happiest when he's productive. Okay, so he doesn't have to work 8 hours a day, but he could put in some kind, he should do something productive in a day. To allow a day to go by without being productive is, according to Rashi, in the eyes of the Torah, an improper way of life, which leads a person, the Talmud, for instance, says, the Talmud has a statement, which is that in Hebrew it's batala mevil deshimon. Doing nothing leads to devastation. It leads to a person disintegrating ethically, morally, and physically, in every way. As a matter of fact, even physically, I read recently where they say that a lot of people over the weekend, they just, you know, they're looking for this rest, and they just lay around all day, and they say that they really, over a 2-day period, the body really does, it's not good for the body, it takes its toll, and it's actually counterproductive. But the Torah, that's the philosophy according to Rashi. So according to Rashi, it's no human being whether Ben Israel or Ben Noach should be idle. But since Ben Israel has so many obligations, it's impossible for him to be idle. As David pointed out, from the time you open your eyes in the morning until you go to sleep, you're busy all day. Now, the Ben Noach, since he only has the seven laws, so he doesn't have this kind of positive obligation, so he must not allow even one day to go by in which he isn't productive in some way. He doesn't have to work a six-hour day, but some kind of productivity you should do. A human being should not allow a day to go by without being productive in some shape, form, or manner. That's Rashi's concept. So I just want to show you that while Rashi is not the mainstream interpretation of the law, nevertheless his idea is not crazy. His idea does have a sound philosophical basis. That's where you heard that idea that you can't take a day vacation. I'm trying to explain it a little more clearly, and at first it sounds absurd, okay?
Rabbi?
Yeah.
Okay. Here's the point then. Suppose we, we go over to the cabin at the lake.
Right.
All right. If we sit on the porch in the swings, and as Jim Dalton says, this is a good topic for the front porch. And we go out there and we sit on in the swings and in the chairs, and we discuss one of the Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach, or the implications of it. If it's for 5 minutes or 5 hours, then that would be work, would it not? Would that be considered work?
That's a good question. That is a good question. You mean according to Rashi, would that be considered work if you were involved in the study of the mitzvot? That's a good question. I would like to think. I'd like to do a little more thinking about that. That happens to be a good question. According to Rashi's opinion, would that be considered working? I'd rather than answer you on the spot, I'd rather think about it. Okay. Again, this is only according to Rashi. According to Maimonides, this is no such question.
Okay, but let me give you another point. So here's a point that I fail, and this is there's no disrespect to you or any of the rabbis in this statement. Every time this subject has been breached, there's always the emphasis put on the fact that you just have seven laws, and yet we have never been told to actively pursue these and spend time studying Torah to identify the laws and the positive and the negative admonitions. In fact, we said, well, you can't study Torah because it's not yours.
Well, that's exactly what I wanted to point out, as a matter of fact.
All right, but see, how are we to know without the study of Torah? You can't just go up to Lawrence Ledford and say, hey, boy, you don't commit idolatry. You understand that?
Right.
You've got to explain to him why and how.
Why?
And you can't do that without Torah.
That's absolutely right.
And then Lawrence is going to have questions, and we're going to have to be philosophical about it. We're going to have to study all the ins and outs and the things that we've been doing for the last 20 years.
That's correct.
And so when you get up at 5 o'clock and study till 1 o'clock, that's work. But what if we start at 1 o'clock and we go to 1 and 2 o'clock in the morning that we've done many times, and you've been at my house at 1 and 2 o'clock in the morning studying Torah?
Now, again, according to Maimonides, there's not even a question that is perfectly fine. Your question is according to Rashi's opinion. And as I said, that's not the mainstream opinion, but the question nevertheless is a valid one according to Rashi. And the point you're making is that, which the Talmud says, that the real ideal Ben Noach, and you know very well that, and this is something you mention all the time, that while, you know, seven laws sounds like, well, they're very nice, they just don't have to do anything. But you know very well that the ideal Ben Noach is one that's involved constantly in the study of Torah. That is the picture, the image of the ideal Ben Noach. And that means, as you have stated, the studying of those seven laws. And believe me, you could spend your entire life and you will not finish the complete study of the seven laws in the Talmud, because it's very intricate and very deep, and it's something which is like all the other parts of the Torah, which is really infinite. I mean, no human mind has ever claimed to finish the Talmud. So, and I would suggest that we do start this, because I think this is very important. As a matter of fact, in the yeshiva this coming year, I plan to study the areas of the Talmud that deal with these seven laws myself and with my students. And perhaps when I get there, we could make some kind of arrangement to go over the, you know, maybe once a week or so, give a little class on the in-depth study of the seven laws, not like, you know, most people think it's just seven simple laws. That I think would be an excellent thing. It's a scientific process. It's abstract thinking, and I don't know if everyone can follow all the way, but some of you can, and some will, you know, just go to a certain stage, just like in the yeshiva, where not everybody is on the highest level, but each person finds their own level. We could try that in the future. I would personally think it's extremely important, because when you study the Talmud and the seven laws and the whole approach, it's a different kind of a thing. It has a different meaning. Just like now we're discussing the Sabbath. Most people don't understand what it means, a positive commandment to abstain from work on the Sabbath. They don't have the concept. But these ideas, you have to study these ideas, and you understand them philosophically and halachically, and it's a different world, a different religious world for the person. I agree with David 100% on that. But nevertheless, I'm still going to think about that question that you asked me as far as Rashi is concerned, whereas I want you all to know that according to Maimonides, this is not even a question and there's no problem. But according to Rashi, it happens to be a good question. If the Ben Noach is involved in study, would that be considered for him work? Okay, again, give me time on that one. I'll get back to you. Okay. Okay, where are we at now? Okay, so should I just continue? Alright, so we were discussing the kashrus. Now the question is, how do you have a positive law not to eat certain animals? That seems to be a negative thing. Okay, negative again is abstention, positive is doing. So positive is like putting on phylacteries, that's positive. Negative would be abstaining from a certain activity, like not wearing a garment that has wool and linen. So that's a negative. Okay. Now, how do you have a positive when it comes to abstaining from certain animals? Logically, it doesn't seem possible. If you take a look at Maimonides, when he talks about the laws, when he formulates his laws in his 14 books. So he says that there is a commandment to know and to differentiate between the various animals, the kosher animals and the non-kosher animals. And he quotes the verse right here in Deuteronomy. And, I'm sorry, it's in, my mistake, it's in Leviticus. In Leviticus 11:47, it says, to differentiate between the unclean and between the clean, and between the animal, this means the wild animal that is eaten and between the wild animal that is not eaten. So Maimonides says that is the positive commandment. The positive commandment is to differentiate. In other words, it's not enough for a person just to eat kosher. Let's say, for instance, a person was never fed something non-kosher. He doesn't really fulfill the mitzvah according to this. The commandment, is really to know and to gain knowledge to differentiate between the kosher and the non-kosher. Now, why is it so important to differentiate? The reason is, as I said before, it's not that God dislikes certain animals. A camel is not inferior to a sheep, and any animal, any creature, even if we may find it disgusting personally, to God, it's God's creature. And we say that, as a matter of fact, we say God's mercy is on all creation. So, and that means the species as well, every species. So these are all the works of God. So God does not despise any of his creatures. But what it means is that the idea of kosher is to raise a person to a state of holiness where he has a supremacy of the mind. In other words, the mind distinguishes. And the mind distinguishes and differentiates between a certain type of food that he may eat, certain type of food that he must not eat. And before he indulges in a physical desire, he has to go through...
In rela- relation to kashrut, mm-hmm. you've got God giving Noah and these people the
the clean and unclean animals.
Clean and unclean.
I'm going to get to that.
Okay, all right.
I'm going to get to that too soon.
Okay.
Now the let me get back to this point. The point is that with regard to the keeping the kashrut, the main idea of the kashrut is, as the verse says in Leviticus, to differentiate. Differentiation means intellect. For instance, in the when we say Havdalah, now I don't know if that means after the Sabbath, there is a certain blessing. They say to differentiate between Sabbath and the rest of the week. Now, in the prayers, in the 18 prayers, we place it in the very first blessing, after the first three. As you remember, there's three, and then we start the requests. The first request is for knowledge, and in there we mention the fact that the Sabbath is leaving, and now we differentiate between the Sabbath and between the rest of the week. Why? Because knowledge and differentiation is one. As I mentioned last week, that knowledge all begins with differentiation, classification. That's why Adam was classifying the various animals. He was differentiating. That's how science begins, by noticing differences. Now, the Torah is telling you here that to keep kosher is not, this is really where the secret of kosher. If people would look into the Bible, into the Torah properly, they'd see it's right there, to differentiate. Now, to differentiate means, and this, I want you to listen carefully to this idea. See, most people have an idea of self-control. Now, self-control is not really, in the eyes of the Torah, the ultimate idea. I'll explain to you why. See, self-control means when you have one emotion against another. For instance, a person wants to look good, so he doesn't want to overeat, he wants to diet. That we call self-control. But you have to understand that in that case, the person is just going for one form of personal desire over another. His vanity is telling him to diet, and his desire, his appetitive desire, wants to eat. So he's in conflict. That's what we call self-control, a person that could control one desire with another desire. This is not really what kashrut is. Kashrut isn't really a study in self-control. It's something more. It really is to raise a person to a higher level where he does things because of the supremacy of the mind. That's a different kind of a concept. That's a little bit higher than the modern-day idea of self-control. The Torah's ideas, as usual, are on a little higher philosophical level than the masses of people. And when the Torah talks about self-control, it means not just controlling one emotion because of another one. There you really didn't go too far. You're basically involved in your instinctual emotions, just one instinct over another. But over here what the Torah is telling you is that you should recognize the area of the mind and of thought, to differentiate, to study the laws of kashrut, to understand them. And then when you abide by them, it's not because you're just controlling yourself, it's because you're recognizing that the world of ideas, of Torah, has a supremacy over the world of the instinctual. That's a whole philosophy. That's a whole way of life. That's a commitment to a certain sphere of reality, the world of Torah ideas. It's not just self-control. There's a big difference between self-control and what the Torah calls the being holy. See, being holy isn't just controlling oneself. It's much more. It means the recognition of the world of ideas, the differentiation, the understanding, the knowledge. That's how kashrut is a positive commandment as well. Now, as you know, a ben noach can do any positive commandment. So in the Torah. So Ben Noach can keep kashrut, but he should make sure when he does it that he has the proper notion, the proper idea. It's not because the pig is a bad animal or he's dirty or trichinosis or anything like that. It's because if you want to do it properly, then you have to understand gain some knowledge of the kosher and non-kosher, and the concept of kashrut should be understood as a commitment to the sphere of the ideas, God's ideas of halacha and Torah. Then the person is raised to a higher level and he lives a higher kind of existence. That's why the Torah mentions the holiness over here. Okay. Now it's interesting to note that the commandment of not cooking the goat in its the kid in the milk of its mother is mentioned again in the area that we are doing in Deuteronomy 14, right at the end where it says, and we're going to come back to this verse, because by the way, this verse has very much to do with the Ben Noach, with the Ger Toshav. That's Deuteronomy 14:21, where it says you shouldn't eat any animal that died of itself, and then it says you should give it to the Ger. This is the Ger Toshav, the stranger. And then it says, and he should eat it, or you should sell it to the to a Gentile. That's not a Ger Toshav. Why? Because you're a holy nation to God your God. You should not cook a kid in the milk of its mother. This is one place where you have the idea of not cooking the goat in the mother's milk. And there's another place where you have it. Actually, it's the same verse twice. It's in Exodus. If you take a look at Exodus 23:19, and the same exact verse is repeated again in Exodus 34:26. Okay, now just hold that for a moment. I'll get right back to this point. There's one point that I want to mention first, and that is that I just want to show you that when the Torah mentions it in different places, it's different concepts. It's not just accidentally. It didn't just happen to fall there. There's a reason why one is in Exodus and why another one is in Deuteronomy. Okay, now in Deuteronomy, the reason why it's there is because it's coming under the law of supremacy of the soul, of the divine part of man, as we mentioned before. And the reason is because there are two times that you have to exercise the supremacy. One is with regard to things that you can never eat, as I mentioned last week, that a person shouldn't have a fantasy that something is great that he could never have. He has to overcome that. The other thing is, it is very difficult many times for people to exercise even self-control in areas where they're constantly involved. I'll give you an example. Hypnosis, for instance, works for smokers. It does not work for overeaters. And the reason is very simple, because a smoker can get hypnotized and he never has to smoke again. Now, since he never has to go near it, that's it. He's finished with it. There are people, as you know, that can't drink. If they take one drink, that's it. They could never drink. Once they take one, they're gone. With regard to things, they, in that sense, it's easier for them never to touch it than to come in contact with it and be able to abstain. That they can't do. So the Torah recognizes that in man there are two difficult things when it comes to his desires. One is to give up something and say, I'll never have that. That is one kind of emotional pain. One kind of fantasy that's difficult to give up. The other kind is to have something around, commonly around, and then at certain times you must abstain. That's even more difficult for some people. For some people, one thing's difficult. For another, other people, something, the other one might even be more difficult. But the point is that there are two types of exercising of the supremacy of the mind over the emotion, you see. And that's why the Torah places that verse in Deuteronomy 14:21. Because what it's telling you is that there is another kind of supremacy of the mind, and that is with regard to things that are commonly eaten. You always eat the goat, and you always drink the milk, but the combination is prohibited. So they have a prohibition about something that is permissible. You have to restrict it in a certain way. So you have two types of restrictions in this chapter. One type is a total restriction, and the other type is restriction of a thing that you have commonly with you, but under certain circumstances, you cannot have it. You can't have the cheeseburger. You can't have cooking the meat and the milk together. Now, the reason why the Torah mentions it also in Exodus is because this violation, I'll explain to you something which I assume must be bothering you, and that is, how do I, you're all familiar with the fact that we can't eat, religious Jew cannot eat meat and milk together. Now, the question is, the Bible doesn't really say that. The Bible just says you should not cook a kid in the milk of its mother. So if we just took it literally, we would say that it's a specific animal, a specific mother, of a you're not allowed to take that mother's milk and then use that to cook the child, the baby goat. But you know very well that it has nothing to do with that in halacha. In halacha, really, it's any kind of meat and milk, any mammal, actually. You're not allowed to take the milk of the mammal and cook it and use it together in a way that it's cooked according to the Torah law, not just a kid in the milk of its mother. I'll explain to you why the Torah speaks only in terms of the kid in its mother's milk. And that is, if you take a look at Exodus, you'll see that this chapter is right after the the incident of the golden calf. That's Exodus 34:26, and it's repeated from before, from Exodus. What did I miss before? It's Exodus 20. Oh, here it is. It's Exodus 23:19. Okay? Now, the reason is like this. If you take a look at that verse, it says that the first fruits you should bring to the house of God your God. And then it says you shouldn't cook a kid in its mother's milk. What's the connection between the two? Now, you know very well that the primitive people always had these fertility rites, and the first fruits for them was a big source of ceremonies with regard to fertility rites. Now, the Torah, as you know, is essentially its purpose is to wipe out idolatry in every form. So what the Torah says is that when you have that emotion about the first fruits, you shouldn't do any primitive rites with these fruits. You should bring them to the house of God your God. It means bring them to the temple, and There's a whole halachic process. It's explained in Deuteronomy where you place it and to express your thanks to God and to use that emotion in the proper way, to express it properly. And as I said in Torah, the worst emotion is misguided religious emotion. So the Torah here is trying to remove man from an idolatrous kind of emotion and instead direct it towards the true idea of God. And that's why it says you shouldn't cook the the kid in its mother's milk, because there was an idolatrous practice that Maimonides mentions it, where they used to take the goat and they'd cook it in the milk of its mother, thinking that this is some kind of a mystical powers will be here, because this is the very thing that nurtures the child, and they're cooking it in it. So they had these kind of concepts. I mean, I know it sounds strange to us, but these primitive concepts exist even today in a little more distorted form, but in the old days they had these various kind of idolatrous practices. So the Torah, as a matter of fact, somebody told me recently that it was discovered that Maimonides' statement is correct, was discovered very recently through a certain archaeological discovery, that there was such a practice, in fact. And because Maimonides deduces it from the Torah itself, he really didn't see it anywhere. But somebody recently corroborated this. I believe it was in the New York Times. I don't remember offhand right now. But the point is, at any rate, the point is that that's the reason why the Torah mentions that you shouldn't cook the kid in its mother's milk. Because originally, that was an idolatrous practice. Now, you have to realize that the Torah speaks in two frameworks. The Torah speaks in the philosophic framework, and that is the overt Torah. But then the halacha is something which has a specific form to it, and that is different than the Torah itself. Now, let me before, I know it sounds strange, let me explain it to you a little further before it's misunderstood. Let's say, take for instance, you have. Take a look, for instance, in Leviticus 19:27. Okay, so there it states clearly that you're not permitted to destroy which means with a razor, basically, the side of your head and also to shave with a razor on your beard. Okay? That's Leviticus 19:27. Now take a look at Leviticus 21:5. Now here it's speaking about the priests, okay? So it says over here that they shouldn't, they're not permitted to mutilate themselves by making cuts in their head. And then again it says, and they're not permitted to shave their faces. Okay? Now this was already stated previously with regard to all of Israel, not just with regard to the priests. So why does it say over here that the priests can't do it? It would seem that an average Jew would be able to do it. But that is not the case. Now, the Talmud explains why you have it in both places, that it teaches you a specific halacha. There's an additional halacha to be derived there. I'm not going to go into that detail because it's not important for my point. But what I'm trying to share is like this, that the reason why the Torah writes that the priest should not do it is because the Torah is speaking in a philosophical vein as well. And the Torah is saying that these priests have to be holy. If you take a look, it says in verse 6, these priests should be holy to their God, and they shouldn't desecrate the name of their God. Because the priests of the other nations used to do all these things. They used to mutilate their bodies, and they used to shave their heads in a certain way. So therefore, what the Torah is telling you is that kind of a practice would be the highest desecration for the people of Israel if they would get involved in that kind of a practice. So that's why the Torah overtly speaks about the priests, even though it is a practice which is prohibited for every Ben Israel as well. Because the Torah wants to point out that the worst tragedy is not only if the Ben Israel does it, the priests do it, then the whole sanctity of the priesthood is lost. So that is on a philosophical plane. The Torah speaks overtly on a philosophical plane. The halacha is something which is derived through the specific methods of derivation from the Torah. The halacha, of course, doesn't differentiate between the priest and between the average person. But the Torah speaks in the framework of the in a philosophical framework. That's the same thing with regard to the cooking the goat in its mother's milk. The Torah mentions the original idolatrous practice to indicate that is really the most horrible violation if a person did it in that form. But halachically, it didn't stick to the case of the kid in its mother's milk, but rather any mammal in its mother's milk is halachically prohibited. Now, the reason why that is so is very simple, because this prohibition comes under two categories. One category is the prohibition of idolatry, and that is from, and that's the two times that it's mentioned in Exodus. Those are both idolatry, because it's the exact same verse, and it's repeated again after the incident of the golden calf, because that's when they fell to idolatry, because they practiced the worship of the golden calf, so it was repeated again. In Deuteronomy, it comes under another category. There it comes under the category of a person exercising control over his instincts. So this law, this one law, which is mentioned three times in the Torah, comes under two headings. One is idolatry, and the other one is the practice of self-control, exercising control, more than self-control, as I explained before, exercising the supremacy of the part of man that partakes of wisdom over the instinctual part. So that's why it's not just the kid in the mother's milk, but rather it's the any mammal, you see, with milk would be the prohibition. The halacha is not always commensurate with the philosophy. The halacha has its own structure. Over here, you could see how the structure is more appropriate for the second category than for the first. And it does no harm to the first one as well, because it includes the first, but it's even more inclusive. And the fact that it's more inclusive is an important factor insofar as exercising control, because then the control is exercised to a far greater degree. It would be very easy for a person to control himself from eating a specific goat with the milk of its mother. I mean, that'd be a pretty easy thing to do. But with regard to a constant control, exercise of control, there it makes sense to prohibit the combination of meat and milk at all times. So that's why the halachic category is greater than the philosophic category. Okay. That's in this case, you could see why it would have to be greater for the second aspect. Sometimes it has to be greater just because of the way halacha is structured. And for that, you really have to study, as I said, the science of halachic structure. Because halacha is a specific science that has its own rules and its own system. And certain things are possible within the system, certain things are not possible. You can't just do anything in halacha. Sometimes in order to have halacha, you require a very specific kind of structure. So that is also the case many times, where the Torah will speak philosophically, but when you use the methods of derivation of the oral law, you'll see that it's not, it's within keeping of the written word, but it could be broader than the written word because of the way halacha is framed. This is just something I want to bring to your attention. I know that it may sound very abstract, but I think most of you probably grasp what I'm trying to say, even though I'm not giving you specific instances. But that's the basic. That's an important concept in understanding how to decipher, how to interpret the words of the Torah. So here you have these two categories where the same violation comes under. Now. That's basically the reason for kashrus. But there is one more point over here which is important as well. You see, and that is that if you look at kashrus in Leviticus, because kashrus is in two places. Kashrus is in Leviticus and it's also in Deuteronomy. Now, if you take a look at kashrus and Leviticus, the rabbis, the scholars of the oral law, are sensitive to something at the end of the at the end of the chapter. You see, if you take a look at the end of the chapter, you'll see it says that you shouldn't eat, for instance, in 11:41, you shouldn't eat the creeping things and anything that goes on its stomach, that creeps, you shouldn't eat because they are an abomination. Now, you shouldn't make your life an abomination with everything that creeps. Now, that's in 43, okay? Now, and it's repeated again, and take a look at 44 again. You should become holy and you shouldn't make yourself unclean with all the creeping animals, okay? So, Rashi over here quotes the Talmud, which says that, and on verse 45, he says, because I am the God your God took you out of Egypt. So Rashi says, if God would not have taken the people of Israel out of Egypt for this, except for this one reason, it would be already worth it, which is that they don't make themselves unclean with the creeping animals. Okay, now I want to explain to you. Again, it's not that, that God despises creeping animals. This is completely nonsensical. What it means is, that there's something else in keeping kosher which we didn't mention. And that is, Maimonides mentions it in his guide, and that is that there were certain practices that primitive people would do. For instance, they would eat certain things which specifically because they're abominable, like insects or various things. And this is something that the Torah considers to be improper. A man to engage in eating things that are specifically disgusting to him because he feels that some kind of mystical benefit will be gained. That's like that's a type of idolatrous thinking. And that's why the Torah emphasizes that point in the that's why the Bible emphasizes that point in Leviticus 19 in those verses. Because there's another concept that God does not want man to eat things that are disgusting to him because of specifically the primitive people do it specifically. They feel because it's disgusting that there is something, some kind of special powers there that they're going to gain by doing that. And I know it sounds strange, but the primitive mind does think that way. And this is something which the Torah again is against, and that's why the rabbis say that even if God would have taken the people of Israel out of Egypt just to avoid such a type of abomination, this alone would be worth it, because people who are involved in that primitive kind, those primitive kinds of practices remain rooted, all their energies remain rooted in those types. type of practices, and they actually never live on the level of the human mind, where, you know, they never use the Tzelem Elokim, the divine part of man, because this preoccupies all their activities. And that's another aspect of kashrus. I wanted to bring that to your attention. Now, so therefore, there are several headings here. And as I said, you know, before, you know, the whole Torah is a removal from idolatry. And you see here, idolatry cuts through different forms, like even eating things that are disgusting or despicable. That's another kind of form of idolatry which the Torah uprooted through these laws. The next thing I wanted to mention was that the fact that in the you see, why do you have it twice in the Torah? That's a question that one must ask. If it was already given in Leviticus, why did Moses have to repeat it in Deuteronomy? And the answer is because when Moses repeated what Moses did in Deuteronomy, as I said to you, Deuteronomy is really different because Deuteronomy is the words of Moses himself giving, acting as a prophet, giving exhortation to the people. But when Moses did that, what he did was he reviewed certain things which were really basics of the Torah. And the idea of Torah is that just giving rebuke without study and without knowledge is really not of great value. Rebuke has to have knowledge in it also. That's why in Deuteronomy, there's woven these various laws, because while he was giving them exhortation, he was also studying with them. And that's an important principle of Torah, that Torah does not believe in just giving people, you know, exhorting them and rebuking them. What you're supposed to do is teach them. So even though Moses did say things to them where he pointed out their flaws and their shortcomings, he taught them as well. And he repeated certain things which were extremely important. For instance, the Ten Commandments he repeated, and he also repeated the laws of kashrus, because the laws of kashrus, as I said, are basic in terms of the nation. There are two basic areas where a person must always have a supremacy of the intellect, and that is when it comes to the appetitive, what you wish to eat, and when it comes to the sexual. Now, the question, of course, that you would ask is, if that's the case, why didn't he repeat the restrictions in Leviticus, the sexual restrictions as well? Which is a very good question, since those are so important. I believe the answer is that he did really, because he does mention, if you take a look in, it's in Deuteronomy 22, where, is there anything? Just give me a minute here. Yes, 22. And that's 22:13, where he goes
through. Rabbi, we got 60 seconds.
60 seconds, okay. So he mentions the sexual prohibitions with regard to living with another person's wife, and with regard to the laws with regard to divorce. And the reason is because in the original laws, the prohibitions were on incest. And once that's accepted, incest it becomes a law. The person, that's it. You know, the person, a normal person doesn't have his desires going in that area anymore. But then the desires go into the promiscuous. And that's why Moses in Deuteronomy dealt with the laws of promiscuity. So he kept those two chapters were repeated in Deuteronomy, the kashrut and also the sexual restrictions. Okay, I guess that's it.
Okay, we'll pick up.